I've got plastic panels, you can't easily touch the chassis, although I guess you can by way of the microphone jack and so on. So main reason for grounding is human safety. A second reason is for lightning protection. With a good lightning arrestor system and a good grounding system, the system is a hell of a lot safer from being struck with lightning, and almost never, no one gets struck with lightning. The lightning bolt hits near your house. It makes an electromagnetic pulse that gets coupled by all of the metallic conductors in your house and in your ham radio shack, and terrible things can happen from that nearby electromagnetic pulse. Very rarely does any of us get struck. I mean, if you were a lightning bolt and you were looking at your town, the first thing that lightning bolt sees is that huge grid of wiring, which is the Con Ed or the LIPO wiring. The first thing it sees, this great big metal grid, and it says, boy, that looks like a beautiful target. So 99% of the time, when you get lightning damage in your house, it came through the 110-volt line, or the 230-volt circuit, so to speak. So, now, there's a huge number of guys who think that if they establish the world's biggest grounding system on every single antenna and every single piece of ham radio equipment they own, that all television interference will disappear. There's a lot of people with that theory. Almost never is that true. If you've got television interference, you're either radiating some frequencies that get to the television, or your radiating system is close enough to the offended television that it's getting such a strong amount of signal that it's getting front-end overload. So, radio-wise, performance radio-wise, grounding, except for what we've been talking about with these 120 radials for a ground plane type antenna, quarter wave ground plane type antenna, except for that, the grounding system tends to not have very much change in the performance or change in the TDI of your system. So I'm most likely believing that your sailboat falls into a similar area. I could be wrong on this one. And the guys in Brooklyn, some of them own some pretty big sailboats. So let's see what Mel's got to say on this one. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Well, being a past sailor and having once a boat in Sheepshead Bay, a sailboat hanging on a mooring there, the ground plate on the boat, the keel, everything, you know, it's just a part of it. It's, the keel itself normally has these bolts that, you know, from the casted keel, which is lead. So we're talking about maybe, I think we were talking about a sailboat. Is it a sailboat, by the way, Dick?
He definitely said that Cash has a sailboat that he's talking about. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, now if you look, usually the keel is poured of lead. It's a lead keel, and the bolts that come through the hull that bolt the keel in place, that should be grounded also. You should tie that also in with the ground plate, and of course, whatever engine, everything, it should be all well strapped together. You'd be amazed how quick. I've seen electrolysis do things in one season to a boat that literally you would never believe that it would eat away that much material on a boat because of just the mistake of wiring deck over.
That's called galvanic action. See, if you got a chunk of copper and you got a chunk of lead or a chunk of steel, both touching the salt water, you're really creating a battery, whether you know it or not. You can put a voltmeter between some of those items and measure the voltage you're generating. You might even be able to light up a small light bulb. And so you complete that circuit the right way or the wrong way, and one of those metals of your sailboat becomes sacrificial to the other and starts getting eaten away real fast. So there's a whole art and science of properly putting grounding plates and sacrificial metal chunks and whatever on things that are in salt water that are not insulated from salt water. I mean, the nicest kind of a boat from this point of view would be what we call a sink potter, in other words, a powered boat where it's got a completely fiberglass hull and nothing touches the water except the propeller itself. It's just at one point of contact, and if it's made out of the right kind of material, you might be in pretty good shape. Well, a sailboat is a more complicated thing with its keel. So there's a bunch of reasons for you to worry about that grounding plate on your sailboat, Kaj, as I see it. And the radio performance, even if you're on HF frequencies and you're lighting up the mast, I don't think the grounding plate is a big factor. You choose the right kind of an antenna on a sailboat where you're lighting up the forward stay and the aft stay as a combination, as an inverted V antenna, you can make a thoroughly symmetric antenna fed in the center, which requires no grounding at all, the coax going up the mast, so to speak. And there are guys who have done that, and they make a beautiful antenna out of it. So you may not need the grounding plate for radio performance reasons. That's a secondary reason it's there, in my opinion, Kaj. And to KDN, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, great, thanks. I appreciate the help. The boat is fairly well bonded. It's Catalina. You guys know the manufacturer. They do a pretty good job. Thinking just to make sure everything's good, I may extend my stay out of the water for another couple of days and install, because there is no ground plate now. Everything goes through the shaft for the propeller. Not had a problem. I mean, I go through my zinc, so I'm very diligent about keeping up on my zinc for the galvanic action, stuff like that. But it sounds like it's probably worthwhile just to add that in there. Because for HF now, I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to do for an antenna yet, but I got a couple of different ideas. And if I have the extra grounding ability, it'll probably help. And if nothing else, it'll help with everything else, like whether it's lightning. Maybe it'll help a little bit more with action, certainly with DC safety. So I'm going to tie that all in. But I appreciate the help. Always good info, as always. Thank you very much. And to KDN.
Comment, one more comment, Dick.
Yeah, before that comment, let me ask him a burning question I've got here, Kaj, and that is, I'm guessing that your boat was yanked out of the water last fall for periodic maintenance, and somehow the grounding plate got removed, and now you're concerned about whether or not you should put the grounding plate back in immediately. Is that approximately what's going on, Kaj?
No, Dick. Never had one. It's a brand new boat. They don't install them as a rule because everything's bonded right through the shaft of the shaft. It was in the water. I wet stored it all through the winter. They did a short haul, we call it, but I am blocked up and I'm trying to keep it. Drop it back in the water as soon as possible, more for my own interest, but also to help the yard out a little bit. But there was never any ground plate on it.
Does Catalina recommend that there should be a grounding plate there?
I'm going to call them. That's one of my projects, see what they say about it for radio installation. But they, as far as straight up use of the boat without HF rig, no, they don't say that it should be. They say that it'll help more when you look at, I think it's the ABYC regulations or recommendations for lightning protection. Certainly not a requirement of the ABYC, but if you want to do it, it's up to the individual captain to make that modification to his boat.
You got my curiosity. Please tell me what ABYC sounds like. And by the way, do you believe in UAA? All right, I'll answer that on the next go around. What does ABYC stand for?
Oh, boy. And I know it's something Yachting Council, but it's basically, I might have the abbreviations wrong, but it's basically the standard of safety features, electronics, electrical safety. They also go into rigging safety for your, for your mast and holding that up, different safety recommendations. And this is, I remember reading through it. In fact, more of it's coming back to me. Catalina says that to avoid liability, they don't make any assertions as to the lightning safety factor of the boat, that it's up to the individual captain to do it himself, because if they put in a ground plate, bonded the mast and everything all together and said, okay, this boat is now protected as much as possible from lightning, and you still blow a hole in the side of the boat, you can't come back and touch them. I remember reading through that.
That makes an awful lot of sense. The liability insurance would be huge. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
This is K2KEY. I was just going to say that I use the backstay as my antenna on HF, but I think he's got the metallic mask there, so I don't know if it could work on his boat. But I had a wood mask, so the backstay wound up an excellent antenna for HF deck over.
Even if he's got a metal mask, that makes things a little bit more difficult. But if he's a smart enough antenna man, he can make a darn good antenna out of those stays and other things he might want to add. So the metal mask, in my opinion, Mel, is not a showstopper. It's just a little bit of a short-term annoyance until you decide how you're going to seed it, how you're going to resonate it, whether or not you put an insulator in the right spot, and things like that. I'd like to go over to Paul to find out what's going on in space. I hope I haven't forgotten somebody who signed in, so I'm going to give you guys an opportunity to say so now. Did I forget somebody?
Okay, you again.
Okay, you're the man I want to talk to. Hey, Eric, go ahead with anything you want to say. And by the way, after my conversation with you a couple of days ago, and I saw a beautiful PBS program, thank goodness you guys had that on Motor Week, where you talked about using these chemstrips-like things to find out what is the pH of the coolant in your radiator. Nowadays, because we've got so darn much plastic in the radiator system and the impeller system of our water pump of our automobiles, if you're not checking the pH, and if you just forget about your antifreeze and say, I got enough, I'm good down to minus 20 degrees, I don't care, you're going to start eating holes in your car, maybe. Modern-day materials. So I go to three or four aftermarket automobile places today, and I ask them for whatever they've got that allows me to measure pH of my coolant, of my radiator system. And they look at me and said, what planet are you from? What the hell are you talking about? So I'm beginning to think it doesn't exist. You do it for darn good reasons to keep some very expensive hardware running. I'm beginning to think you're going to the drugstore to buy the methods for measuring pH, and it looks like it's not being sold in automobile stores, in which case some of us are very vulnerable, in my opinion. KE2EJ, KQRIW, you got it.
WO2Z. Okay. K2IW, K2J. Yeah, well, I wanted to mention that when you were talking about power supplies before, that broadcasters, they tend to have two schools of thought on that. One is, I'll give you an example. The transmitter that's up at Empire, which is a Channel 13 transmitter, it's a 30 kilowatt transmitter, there's two of them there. What they do is they have this huge transformer and a bunch of huge rectifiers and a huge bank of capacitors. That's it. That feeds the amplifiers. The amplifiers are MRF-151Gs, which is a pair on the same piece of substrate. They produce about 300 watts apiece, and there's enough of them on a board to produce 1,500 watts per board, and there is, let's see, there's 4, 8 is 7, and 7 is 14 on each cabinet associated with the visual, and then there's 2 boards in each cabinet associated with the all. So that's how they generate power. Now, at 21, on the digital transmitter, they have a different philosophy, okay? They actually have three-phase power supplies, switching power supplies, that feed one board that produces about 600 watts. Completely different thinking, okay? And boy, when those things blow up, I've been in the room when they blow up, they're really loud. Actually, one blew up its capacity so bad that it poked a hole in the wall of the power supply. And those power supplies, by the way, are water cooled. If you remember looking at it, we got water going through those chassis. That was one thing. The other thing was is that think about broadcasters like Empire or on my single tower. What happens when lightning hits? It's a pretty interesting thing. For the most part, usually absolutely nothing. Although at World Trade, when World Trade was up, we used to get lightning hits like, twice, three times a week, you know, when it's cloudy out and raining. And there, because of the way things are structured on that particular tower, occasionally you'd lose an output amplifier. why, how it got there without burning everything up, but how it has to get there. I'll explain that on the next one. It's just totally amazing. It's just the broadcasters pretty much have that under control, but yet nothing's perfect. K2IW, K2EJ. Oh, and also, if you don't want to buy the strips at the drugstore because you don't have a good enough ring, there's a couple of chemical supply pages. You can pick it up really cheap.
Yeah, I'm amazed that the aftermarket places haven't started selling it yet, because in theory you ignore this and vital portions of your car could be eaten up. Ian, I think I forgot you by mistake. W02Z, go right ahead, sir.
Yes, just a quick question. Do I have it, or do you want to pass that to the other station?
Ian, for the time being, you got it. You're number one on the runway.
Okay, Dick. Won't stay too long, but quick question. I know you're intimately familiar with this radio. It's the Kenwood TX-711. I picked one of those units up probably 10 years ago, and probably for the last 8 or so years it's been sitting on the shelf. Took it off, dusted it off the other day, hooked it up, and I was running some checks on it. And for some reason, the output, memory serves me, when it was placed on the shelf, it was 25 watts. Now, I've been, you know, checking it on a meter and a dummy load, and I'm only getting 12 watts out of the radio. And I've opened the radio up, looked at everything. There's two variable resistors on the display board that adjust the low-end RF output and the high-end RF output. And I've tried fiddling with those two resistors at no avail. I was wondering if you have any ideas. K2RIW, W02D.
Yeah, that's my favorite rig. Tango Sierra 711A. Beautiful piece of equipment. Very, very well designed. Not compact. But, and when you take that, let's see now. Upper right-hand side of the instrument panel, second thing over from the right, is something called mic RF power. The outer diameter thing of that, when you twist it on mine, it goes from a low of about 1 watt to a high of close to 30 watts. What range do you get when you twist that, and is there a dead region as you twist that, Ian? Go ahead.
Negative, Bill. I've adjusted it all the way down to... the low end is set to 2 watts, and I was able to use a screwdriver and adjust that down to 1-point-something watts. The high end, with just using the front control on the radio, I can go from the low of about 2 watts to the high of about, I think, 10 watts. I just picked up two bird meters, and one was the 4381. And that gives me about a reading of 9.6 watts.
Okay, so I'm hearing the sound of two independent watt meters going into a good dummy load. By the way, the rig does have self-protect. If you're going into an antenna that's got somewhat high standing wave ratio, you won't get full power output. I'm assuming you were either going into a good antenna that had a low standing wave ratio, obvious by what you did with the forward and reverse slug on the bird watt meter, or you're going into a good dummy load. And yet 10 watts output is not a showstopper. Maybe you've got a bland solder joint in the final stage. Mine right now is starting to give me a peculiar characteristic where a year ago it would go completely off the air periodically. I opened it up and I found out that right on the power supply printed circuit board, a cold solder joint existed right where the main rectifier for the power supply touched the board. I re-soldered that problem went away. Recently, I see that my rig, when it's cold, and if I demand full power output when it's cold, I get something like 5 watts. And then it'll stay there on each transmission. I'm having a bunch of transmissions with somebody at full power, and all of a sudden it'll jump up to full 28 watts output. When I look at the schematic diagram, I see that the TR switching is done by dim diodes. And so I beat up this rig something terrible, overheated the daylights out of it at times. By transmitting high power for a long time where it was shoved into a cabinet and it didn't have proper heating, and I've had the thing go into the complete shutdown mode from thermal overload. You allow that internal cabinet to go to I'll pick a number, 100 degrees centigrade, and the thing will completely shut down until it cools off. And I've been in that mode a couple of times, which is a dumb thing to do. So So I'm going to take mine apart and look real carefully at what I may have melted in that final stage and now a pin diode assembly. So it's possible that intermittently I'm getting what you're getting. I'll keep you informed on what I find. I own a very nice... Do I own the service manual? I know I own the owner's manual, and the owner's manual, the so-called instruction manual, does have a very nice schematic diagram. I may also own the service manual on the rig, because I like the things that not much. I may have bought it for this one, like I did for the Kenwood 751A. So we'll eventually find out what's going on. So although you're disappointed that you're getting 10 watts instead of the nearly 30, in reality that means you're 4.77 dB lower than you would like to be. That's a fraction of an S unit. But that's not going to make the difference between a contact and a QSO and a non-QSO. 98% of the time, it's not going to make the difference. So you're on the air. It's just a matter of pride. You'd like to have full power output of the rig. And by way of the resources you have available to you, the schematic diagram, and if you want to get serious, you get a hold of Andy, WA2CDL, and I guarantee he can put you on the road to recovery here. WO2Z, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I was in charge of you to switch back. Thank you on that, Dick. Yeah, I went online today and purchased one of those service manuals just to see if it was something that I could probably fiddle with and get up and running, or it's something I'd probably have to have looked at. And I hear what you're saying on the power. The problem was I just picked up a Henry 2002 AM, which is my second question, whether or not there might be anybody on the net that might be familiar with that amplifier. But I had to, get a tube for it and replace some parts in there, and I finally got it back on the air. And now I'm trying to just see if I could get full output on the used tube that I got with it. But with 10 watts into that amp, it really doesn't drive it as much as I need to. So I kind of need that 20 watts or 25 watts that I can get out of this radio. I'll pass it back to you again, Dick.
Comment, Dick, K-E-Y.
Okay, yeah, Mel first, and I've got another question also. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, this is K-E-Y. Let them check the power supply. They have, I think, in that radio, I remember that radio for some reason, I think they have a pass transistor in there, in the power supply, and a resistor, a nice size resistor, right across it, a load resistor. And I saw, I think it either disconnected or something, but something in the back of my mind pops into my mind about something with the power supply, and it went down to lower power. Only in the transmit, yet in the receiver worked properly, Dick. I don't know if that rings a bell with you, over.
I'm looking at the schematic right now. When you do get the schematic on this thing, Ian, it's going to scare you. The schematic is very dense, very small printing, 30 inches wide, 11 inches high piece of paper that folds in a couple of different places, and it's a double-sided thing. You look at all the stuff that's in that radio, it's going to scare the hell out of you. Don't let them intimidate you, Ian. Hang in there. I'm trying to find the power supply on this great big schematic. And I think I found it. Nope. That's one of the driver stages. And I'm still looking. I wasn't smart enough to put a great big yellow mark around the power supply. Oh, there's the thing with the fuse. And do I see... Oh, that's where 13.8 volts goes in. Yes, there is a big pass transistor. And what Mel is saying now is bringing back a painful experience I had. Another rig, not quite as complicated as this one, I was troubleshooting 15 years ago, where it was low in receiver gain, not moving the S-meter. And I was measuring what gain I was getting out of all the stages, digging deeper and deeper and deeper into the rig. Finally, I decided to measure the power supply. And I found out that the 6-volt reference zener diode was down to something like 4.8 volts. It drove a lot of extra leakage. Therefore, all voltages that were regulated from that reference zener were low, and so the whole darn rig was starving for voltage everywhere, and therefore everything was low in gain. I couldn't find out why, but damn many stages were low in gain. And so that painful experience where I wasted a week of my life taught me a very vital thing. Whenever you open up a piece of equipment, that's not doing exactly what you want. The very first thing you should do, make sure you're not shorting anything out. Do it carefully. Measure every single power supply voltage in all the modes of operation, transmit and receive. And if you're not within 5% of the right voltages out of the power supply, stop right there. Because other than that, if you've got a low power supply voltage, you'll find every single stage is a little bit deficient, and it'll drive you crazy. So word to the wise. And so when you get the schematic on this thing, Ian, it's going to scare you. A lot of stuff in that rig, but it does good things. W-O-2-Z, K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet.
K-2-R-I-W, W-O-2-Z on the TechNet. Well, one of the things I did, I kind of thought about the power supply, too. And this radio has a built-in power supply, which it's running on now. It also has its mobile capabilities, and I had the mobile cable. And I plugged that into a regulated Astron power supply and tested it on both the internal switching supply and the Astron, and getting the same output power. So I'm not sure if what the other station is referring to would be related to the radio being fed by the switching and or the external power supply.
Yeah, what you did is a necessary but not sufficient test. You would have a lot of information if you fed it from an external DC power supply and then you get full power output. The fact that you get the exact same performance that way is no good information. And yeah, one of the things I love about this rig is it runs on its own 110-volt power supply as well as external 14.8. So it's a very nicely contained rig. Not compact, a little bit on the heavy side. Big handle on the side to carry it. Probably weighs 20 pounds, but every one of those pounds are worth it. It's got one of the world's best frequency synthesizers I've ever seen. Really good synthesizer, which moves in 10 hertz steps. Nicely done. Good design. High stability and beautiful spectral purity of that synthesizer. So it's worth making the investment in that rig. I don't care if it's a 1987 rig, which makes it 20 years old. By my standards, it's an oldie but goodie. But that's one man's opinion. I don't have to have the latest and the greatest $3,500 rig. A lot of people do, and a lot of people enjoy it. It's whatever you want to do. So when I find out what the intermittent power output requirement, the causative agent in mine, you and I will keep notes with each other, Ian, and maybe there's a common denominator. Because mine does jump down to something like 5 or 10 watts when I'm commanding full power output. When the rig is cold, it does that repetitively now. Brand new condition, never did it before, but I have cooked this poor thing on a couple of occasions, and the last time I cooked the daylights out of it was 2 weeks ago, and it didn't deserve it. So I'm telling the rig to forgive me. I'm going to, repair is on the way. I think you see where I'm going here. I hope we've covered all the people, but we really should go to Paul before we put him to sleep. He's got to go to work tomorrow morning. He's one of the working class. He's got to go out there and earn all of that Social Security money to keep us retired people, Mel and me. I'm semi-retired, but still I'm on Social Security. And so we want Paul to work as hard as he can to put all his money into Social Security so we keep getting these checks. WS2N, the man who's supporting us, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Okay. I don't know about that. Dick, didn't have really much here. I looked up on the internet to see if I could find anything new about the Hubble Space Telescope. I don't see anything new or worthwhile even discussing, you know. Hopefully they'll do it. We'll have to see. I think so. Nothing. I don't know if you've heard anything in that regard lately, Dick. But, I don't know. Most of the stuff that's out there right now is concerned with the International Space Station and getting that thing built. I think after that, another year of building, I think you'll hear about the Hubble Space Telescope. You know, you've got quite a few launches scheduled for this year, and the next one I think is coming up in April. It was delayed, and it's back in the vehicle assembly building, getting all fixed up after that hailstorm that pretty much wiped out quite a bit of the insulation on the external tank. So we'll see what happens there, Dick. I didn't really have that much. I did want to ask you a quick trivia question, because it was on Jeopardy, so if you want to answer that, I think you'll come up with the answer. I actually got the answer wrong, because you know how that game is. It goes up very quick, and I didn't think of what I had to think of fast enough, but I thought about it, of course, afterwards, and I thought, okay. Here we go. It's what person said in the year 1961, May 5th, the statement, "What a beautiful view. What a beautiful view." I wonder if you know that, Dick. Back to you.
Was that Alan Shepard?
Yeah, it's using quick, much quicker than I do. Yeah, right away I came out with John Glenn, you know. I was he was in 62. You know, the year just like went flying right by me, Dick.
Okay, got any other trivia questions, Paul?
If that's what you like, I could dream them up all day long, but that was on Jeopardy. And it was good to see the guy got it right, by the way. Yeah, that was, he went like 5,000 miles, and you know, that was a suborbital flight, and the first suborbital flight, they had another one after that, and then four more orbital flights in the Mercury program. They were great days, Dick. We used to sit and watch the TV in grade school, put everybody in a hall with a black and white TV down the end of the hallway and watch these launches, and sometimes they were scrubbed, and you come back, you know, a couple hours later, the next day, or whatever it was. A lot of fun. But, no, I'll dream up, yeah, that's always good if you like them, Dick. We'll dream up trivia questions for you.
On that instant, when Alan Shepard made that suborbital flight, I was an electronic engineering technician at Telephonics Corporation on Ponk Avenue in Huntington. I was being trained on a particular PRC-49 radio. This is a radio that pilots carry when they get when they bail out of their airplane, they get dumped into the drink. PRC-49 gets turned on, and the guy can holler Mayday on or talk to the aircraft that's rescuing him on 121.5 or 243 megacycles. And so the person was giving me instruction on how to do the testing of a PRC-49 radio because everybody was so proud of the fact that we were doing our first astronaut launch into space. The audio of that launch was being put over the PA system. The particular person giving me instruction was so hell-bent on his job, he didn't stop. I had to listen with one ear what was going on with Alan Shepard's flight and listen to this guy and appear to be giving him my full attention while he's giving me instruction on how to test the sensitivity of that receiver. So I remember that episode pretty well. I lived through it in a way that was a little bit frustrating. Where were you during that instant, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW, and the Tech Man.
Hey, I remember also, yeah, I was not working at the time, but I remember, yeah, everybody took a break. Oh, I think, you know, I think it was at Grand Central. We were doing a special piece of equipment that we were setting up there at Grand Central. Who did I work for at the time? I think it was with Zenith. Yep. Zenith was installing monitors, and I believe that's when I saw it there. They had big monitors set up in Grand Central, Dick, over.
Okay. Now, that particular episode, not everybody knows where they were. Everybody knows where they were on September 22, 1961, when John F. Kennedy got shot. And I guess a lot of us know where we were when the Columbia disaster occurred and so on. We certainly know where we were on 9/11. So these are a couple of history days that will really stick in our minds. Mel, how has the email been this week? And what subject do you think we should be covering? K2KEY, K2RIW.
1963, not 61.
He's right. Sorry about that. There's 2001. I knew there was a 1. 2001 and 9/11. Go ahead, Mel.
Roger. This is K2KEY. Yeah, well, 63 when Kennedy was assassinated. I was one day being discharged from the Army and got held over. I said, no. Don't tell me we're going to have breakout into another war if something here is going to happen. Something's going to hold up my I discharged. It was amazing. I just couldn't believe it. I said to myself, something's got to happen, something. I never put two and two together that would be this, something like this. But fortunate enough, after a couple of days, we had ceremonies and everything and all, and out I went. Anyhow, let's see. What should we discuss? Well, we want to talk a little bit more about shunt feeding towers. I've been just going over some things here, and it's some amazing, very amazing things that Jerry Civic and John True came up with here in short, shunt feeding towers. And they go into it in detail. Now, you know, what happens if the tower is too tall? That's another point. Sometimes the tower is too tall and there's too much antenna up there. And he talks about that, and he found that the ideal, that's what he did, he came up with the ideal situation. Now he also talks about another problem, that where the tower sections are bolted together, that there may be a problem with the where it bolted together, he says, of rusty joints and whatever, getting into the, you know, where the two pieces come together, and about jumping, putting straps across it and all. He really did a phenomenal sheet. This is such a research project on shunt feeding, but about how also the matching capacitors down on the bottom and what to expect. And let's see. Oh, my God. The amount of current that he's talking about down on the bottom of the bulges, gee, this is pretty phenomenally high. So, again, I don't know. I think of the safety factor on this, Dick, of what's down there right at the ground level, that you've got to build a fence around this thing. I would, you know, I only tried it, but I don't know. I felt that it was like a danger, this rod sitting down there with what's concentrated down on the bottom for, got a lot of cats here and squirrels, you know, and things like that, even though the yard is closed off to human beings, but animals, I would break my heart if I ever saw an animal get hurt for some reason from my antenna system. K2RIW in the text net. This is K2KEY.
For the most part, Mel, you're being more conservative than you have to be. When you look at the ANSI spec, American National Standards Institute, C95 spec, which is the main defining document for the United States with reference to radio frequency biohazard, when you go below 30 megacycles, the curve of maximum permitted exposure rises at, I'm guessing, something close to 6 dB per octave, all the way down to something like 1 or 3 megacycles. And so when you're down to HF frequencies, you can put a lot more watts per square centimeter into a human being, and it's safe, because as you go down in frequency, the majority of the RF energy flows through you and doesn't stay. It's the 30 to 300 megacycle region, which is the most stringent requirement, because in the 30 to 300 region, the majority of the RF that hits you gets absorbed and turned into heat. And when you go above 300 up to 1500, then it rises again, up to 1500 megs is where it hits a 5-to-1 rise. So when you see the curve of maximum permitted exposure versus frequency, it's a bathtub-shaped curve. It's got a flat spot to the left. It goes down to the bottom of the bathtub, and it comes back up again. It's got another flat spot to the right. And so when you're down at HF frequencies, you're in that lower flat spot. By very simple current detecting probes, Mel, you could take a piece of RG58 cable, strip away the center conductor for an inch or two, loop it back, and solder the center conductor to the shield. That would be a current sensing sniffer probe. Without much difficulty, you could theoretically you could calibrate that. In other words, you know the area of the loop, therefore what it picks up would be pretty easy to figure out. You could then put that into whatever instrument you've got that can measure power. It could be a high-speed oscilloscope, it could be a spectrum analyzer, it could be a low-power watt meter, a milliwatt meter, a microvolt meter, whatever, a receiver. There's all kinds of ways You could put it into a calibrated piece of equipment. You could bring that loop near the base of your tower and put it anywhere you want and measure what is the real field in that area. So when in doubt, make measurements. I think there's a 99% chance that what you're worried about is safe as all hell. Because the antenna is taking a fierce amount of power, if you're putting a kilowatt into it, and radiating it over a significant number of square feet of radiator. And so it doesn't have the ability to concentrate the way you're worried about. When you're down at 80 meters, where the wavelength is 265 feet or something like this, and you're talking about structures of a couple of feet in dimensions at the base of the tower, you may have some strong local E fields and H fields there, but it's not a radiating field. You haven't set it up as that part of the structure intended to radiate, so to speak. And the real antenna itself, the tower, which is very similar to the center of an 80-meter full-wave, half-wave dipole, you can put a kilowatt into it, and as long as you're more than a couple of feet from the wire, you're relatively safe because it's spreading out that power over the whole 135 feet of that wire. So a hell of a lot of the things that people think would be unsafe are really safe. I'm very saddened along these lines on what's about to happen in Bayville. According to the website for the town hall, on April 24th, the community is going to come together and do a vote as to whether or not all the antennas in the town should be removed. I may be overquoting it, I may be misquoting it a little bit, but there is going to be a vote on the acceptability of the antennas in the town for the cell phone, the police, the fire, and whatever. And I'm very saddened by this because it's a strong misunderstanding of the lack of knowledge. Xenophobia is what's going on. Someone in the community has convinced a lot of people that antennas and radio are unsafe. And nothing could be further from the truth. And so even if they succeeded in voting all the stuff down, the Department of Homeland Security is about to come in there and read them the Riot Act, saying you will do it and you will enjoy it. If they have to condemn the property to do it, they will do it. The federal government has said there is no danger from this thing. They're not saying there's little danger. They're saying there is none, particularly in the way they're being used. And so, as you can tell, I'm back on my hobby horse. I'll get back off here. Mel, you probably got some emails you should be covering. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, most of the emails, like I said, we've covered the subject, so it'll just be redundant. And many of them, I can't comment. In fact, I got mail. Gee, you should see the mail on some of these things. People sending brochures on pieces of gadgets and equipment that these companies are going on the market and going to try to market these different things, a number of things for automobiles, different types of devices for automobiles, supposedly safety gadgets and all the future, and whether or not you would invest in these companies and all that, which, again, I can't, I'm not going to even, bother with them. And also got to tell you something. I don't know how to describe this. This thing looks like a piece on some kind of a piece of gadgetry. I don't know what it is. I'm telling you, page after page, spaces between it. If I would just critique each one of these particular questions, on each page and spaces, so I could critique, the statements and all. But I can't. I don't know. I really can't sit down and, in all honesty, and dope this thing out really step by step. So this just needs, again, somebody that I guess is in the business of doing reviews of PCs. Here, in fact, let's get back to this shunt feeding of the tower. In his experiment, he says we went up to 1,500 watts, and the series capacitor we used at the base was rated at 1,500 volts. It arced over and burnt up pretty severely. We changed over, and we found out that we would use a 300 TF vacuum variable rated at 5,000 volts, which should be able to handle, which was able and should be able to handle any kind of transmitter on 40 meters. And this thing is operating on 40 meters. He says also you must be careful because this series capacitor is also carrying several amperes of current at the base, Dick. This is, so this is what I'm saying. It seems to be quite a bit concentrated right down at the ground level, over.
Yes, I can understand how that happens, Mel. In the case of that 50-foot antenna, which wants to be 65-foot tall, quarter wave at 80 meters, and electronically you're tuning it by way of the five-element Yagi on top. It's a top hat capacitor, top hat loading thing. It's very close to resonant. On 80 meters, my guess is that's a nice, friendly feed. But when you go all the way down to 160 meters, and the poor radiator is now only an eighth of a wave tall, depending on what method you choose to try to resonate that whole structure, your reactive power is going to be fierce. There are ways around that. There's ways you could modify by make it more of a delta instead of a gamma and whatever, and taper the sizes and the spacings. There's ways you could lower the fact that there's a high voltage or a high current at a particular point in the feeding system. So there are ways you could get around that. I mean, if you take a look at the waveguide to coax adapters that they put on radar transmitters that are running 10 megawatts of peak envelope power, I mean, when I build an X-band waveguide to coax adapter, I take a little piece of 18-gauge wire, mount it onto an SMA connector, screw it through the wall, make it roughly a quarter wavelength long, a quarter wave from the short circuit end of the waveguide, and I've got a launcher. But you wouldn't want to put 100 watts through that. You'd burn it up. And so there are very, very specific things you've got to do to run high power through circuits, big round objects and whatever. And there are ways of modifying the design. I mean, this guy is very familiar with gamma matching of normal quarter wavelength things if it's grounded on one end, or half wave if it's a symmetric antenna. He's familiar with that setup of a gamma rod. But when you've got an antenna that's only an eighth wave long, that gamma rod has got to work awful hard. And there are other ways of doing that. But common sense would lead you to believe that the gamma rod is doing a lot of the radiating. Believe it or not, I think it is not. It's a hard-working impedance matching device. The tower itself, whether it be grounded or ungrounded, the tower itself is the thing that I think is doing 98% of the radiation there, Mel. And if you did do a field strength measurement at the base of that tower, even with that elaborate gamma rod, as long as you're more than 1 foot from all the hardware, I think you're likely to be safe. I will admit that with arcing over a 3,000-volt vacuum variable capacitor, you put your hand on that thing, of course you're going to be in a fair amount of trouble. You're at least going to get an RF burn in your hand. You're not going to get electrocuted, but the amount of RF energy that will be put into the first 16th of an inch of the skin on your hand will, in the place where you touch it, it'll, in 24 hours, raise a little white lump of dead flesh. I've done that in the past. Been there, done that. Back to you, Mel. Oh, by the way, I do recommend, Mel. I see the nature of the mail you're getting. I've been there. When I started publishing a lot of articles in QST Magazine, my goodness, was I getting mail. People making all kinds of, to them, reasonable requests. The request was not reasonable because I was getting 300 of them per year. I just couldn't keep up with it. I do recommend that either today, tonight, I mean, or next week, you make a clear statement over the year of what you recommend people send to you as email or as snail mail, and what you cannot handle. I think you're going to have to make a statement, Mel. Otherwise, you're going to fill up your mailbox. You sound like a guy that's got a lot of the answers, and they've been looking for one of those. They found him. He's in Brooklyn. he's in Manhattan Beach. He's easy to get a hold of by snail mail and email, and as such, I think you're going to have to make a statement, Mel. Unless you enjoy having your mailbox filled up. K2KUI, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2MLB.
Okay, K2MLB, recognize that this is K2KUI. Well, the point is, Dick, I'm not going to comment on anybody's ideas of investment. I'm not an investment counselor, and I'm not going to review, you know, these companies and find what basically, you know, do the research and find out basically what they're doing in the field that they're particularly they're interested in investing in. Number two, as far as, I guess the The things I did with mathematics, you know, methods of explaining math and all, so-called, you know, simplifying some of it, I guess this is where a lot of it came from. I keep getting questions about if I can give them a simpler way of doing certain types of mathematical procedures. Some of them I answered, as long as it pertains to amateur radio. I'm not going to get into something that pertains to the commercial field. If it's an amateur radio doing, you know, a how to apply, what formula to apply to determine something, and I get the antenna field of amateur radio or something associated with it, I answer. But I'm not, like I say, I'm not going to do somebody, you know, homework, because some of this stuff, this one came, this is pages and pages. This is definitely somebody that is interested in most likely an engineering program and doing some work on it, and I would assume this is more than for possibly, I don't know, like for a, possibly a master's program, and I just, like I say, I'm not able to get into it in that detail. That takes a lot of study. So that's what I say. Listen, I tell everybody, if it's an amateur radio question, a straightforward amateur radio question associated with this amateur radio, like we're doing here, I'm more than glad to try to help you out, but I can't, you know, cover all ground. This is what it comes down to. So, K2MLB, go ahead with your question. This is K2KEY and the text message.
Yeah, hi, Mel and Dick. I've still been here listening. Listen, before you leave, Dick, one last question. I'm not even going to broach the shunt feed part of the problem, but strictly on the ground. And I don't think I'm going to have a chance to do anything before we talk in the next week or two. But in terms of the ground wire, I have a nice spool of 1,500 feet of, that somebody gave me. It's beautiful looking, but it's enameled aluminum wire. It's an oddball gauge. It's 15. It looks great, etc. But I'm just wondering, with all the work involved in, you know, installing radios, would you use this? You know, I could scrape the enamel off where I have to solder it, or what would you recommend? In other words, to save the money on the wire, I don't want to use the wrong stuff because of all the labor involved.
Okay, you don't have to scrape off the insulation. I mean, if somebody gave you wire with rubber covering on it and you're going to sink that in the ground, don't worry, it'll work like a charm. The rubber covering will give it a little bit more protection, the wire will last longer. And in that particular case, if we are putting in ground plane radials, the fact that they're aluminum instead of copper and they're not silver plated, not a problem. The only problem you've got is soldering the aluminum to make good electrical contact right at the base itself where you bring it all together. There you're going to have to be a little bit careful. Since the electrical contractors back in the day when aluminum wiring in houses was popular, they were using a special kind of a salve and a pigtailing technique, where one wire is twisted around another wire for a certain length with the right kind of juice in there and weatherproofing. If you're willing to do a little bit of that extra effort to make sure you've got good contact that's not making a scratchy contact, you don't want an arcing, scratchy contact, a rusty nails phenomenon, and aluminum oxide building up on wire that's not making a good bonded joint. You'd like it to be an aluminum solder joint. Well, all of my experience, you buy the right kind of fancy flux solders that will allow you to solder to aluminum. Indoors, it works very well. Every time that I've done it outdoors, it corroded pretty fast and the contact was broken. Maybe I didn't do the right procedure. Maybe I didn't use the right stuff. So keeping good electrical contact to aluminum is a bit difficult. But as long as you're willing to check that periodically and do a little bit of extra effort there, I think that 1,500 feet of wire could be, the price is right, and RF-wise performance, except for the one point of contact at the base of the tower, other than that, it's going to fly like a charm, in my opinion, Frank. Back to you, sir.
Okay, well, that was the question, Dick. When I said scraping off, I meant, you know, where I was going to solder it. Now, you've raised enough of a question in my mind that I'll look into it more thoroughly, and maybe I will, you know, bite the bullet and buy the right stuff. Okay, as always, thank you for your help, K2MLB.
Okay, we had a double or a triple there. I think I heard somebody called NEG. Give us your call and your name, sir. Okay, your audio is extremely heavy and it's so distorted. I think you're saying W-A-2-N-E-Z, November Echo Zulu, but you're going to have to back off on that mic. Go ahead.
Okay.
All righty. Well, what's your name, sir, and what would you like? Okay. Was there a second person who was signing in?
Intuio.
Go ahead, Rich.
I got a trivia question for you, Dick. Who was the first human in space?
Lots of people think it was Yuri Gagarin, but am I wrong?
Not of my belief, it was Yuri Gagarin. He was a Russian. He was also a ham, by the way. He was the first Russian, the first human in space, as far as I know. Alan Shepard was the first American in space.
Understand. And the first animal in space, I think, was the chimpanzee. The first American animal in space was the chimpanzee named Ham. There's a pun there somewhere. I wonder if you knew about that one.
You jogged my memory. I vaguely remember that, but I wouldn't have come up with it. All right, I didn't stump you on Yuri Gagarin. By the way, he died, I think, about 15 years ago.
Yeah, I think they...
WS2N?
Yeah, I think he died in an accident. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, what flight was Ham on? That's now the new question. What flight did Ham the chimp go on?
Was it a Redstone rocket?
QSO. What was the number of the flight? Mercury what?
I don't know.
Okay, Mercury 2. The second Mercury flight. They had Mercury 1. Mercury 2, and then we know who was on 3, Shepard.
Hey, Rich, here's one for you. The Russian dog that flew in space, what was his name?
You got me, Dick.
I got it, Dick.
I think his name was Laika. Is that true, Paul?
USL, you got it. The only problem is, I don't like the way they did it. He didn't make it back. He got up there, but, you know, they died in space.
What was the name of the first female in space?
Should I answer, or are you going to open it up to the net, Dick?
I'll open to the net first, and then we'll go to Paul. Anybody want to volunteer? What's the name of the first female in space?
I think her name was a Russian name. My first name was, Lara, I think. Was it Lara? Wait a minute. Let me catch it again. I know she's Russian name. I'm trying to remember the pronunciation over.
WA2AHF.
AHF, go ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
Name is Ed, Echo Delta, and I believe her name was Valentina Tereshkova, and she flew in the capsule Vostok 6.
Paul, is he right?
Valentina Tereshkova, she was the one, first Russian, and she was a parachute, you know, they would parachute back to Earth. So there's always a question of whether or not the Russians, Yuri Gagarin, made a complete trip, because right at the end they would launch themselves out of the spacecraft and parachute to Earth, and that's why she was chosen as well.
Once again, she was chosen because
parachuting. She knew that parachute. What they would do is they would re-enter the atmosphere and come before they got to Earth. You know, when they were still up, you know, a mile or two, or whatever it was. They would launch themselves, they would hit a button and blow themselves out of the capsule and then float to space, float to the ground, and that's how they got back from space. The craft would land, but if they were to stay into that craft, the shock would kill them. The parachutes weren't big enough, the spacecraft was too heavy, whatever.
Fascinating stuff. Okay. Here I don't know. What was the name of the first female astronaut from the United States?
I'm going to pass it because I know it. You know, give it to the net.
Okay, fellas, show us your space intelligence. Who was the first American female in space?
Sally Ride.
Sally Ride. Is that correct, Paul? And, I mean, it sounds to me like Eric came up with that. And, Eric, what was the name of the craft she was on?
Now you got me.
Okay, you got a little bit of feedback, as you know. Paul, you're going to have to tell us that one. What was the name of the craft that Sally Ride was on? It wasn't Sally Ride.
Sally Ride Challenger. Very good, Dick. Yeah, we can go on and on with this. The first female to walk in space, American spacecraft.